Welcome to Mentioned in Dispatches, the podcast from Western Front Association, with me, Dr. Tom Thorpe. The WFA is the UK's largest Great War History Society. We are dedicated to furthering understanding of the Great War and have around 6,000 members worldwide. For more information, visit our website at westernfrontassociation.com. It is the 12th of June 2025, and this is episode 360. On this week's podcast, Clive Harris explores the role of London Territorials at Gallipoli in 1915 and 1916. Though no full London Territorial Division served on the peninsula, six London Regiment battalions, five Yeomanry regiments, and two support units took part. Around 8,500 men were spread across various formations serving in the Dardanelles Peninsula. Clive talks about their experiences, lessons learned, and the lasting impact of the campaign on many of its participants. This talk was recorded in June 2024 as part of the London Pride Conference that explored the history of the London Territorial Force from 1908 to 1921.
Great. Well, any of you who do know me will understand that it's normally from the clock starting to about 3 minutes before I mention the words London, Gallipoli and football. So I've known Charles for 25 years, so I'm used to being voluntold to write chapters in books. This is one of the ones that I jumped at the opportunity to do so, because it encapsulates all three areas that I'm particularly passionate about, and despite all my travels over the last 30 plus years in the industry, if I had one day left on a battlefield, it would be to Gallipoli. So for me, this is a real privilege to be able to present on the London Regiment and their time at Gallipoli. So what makes it kind of unique, really? Well, the first thing is the six infantry battalions that London sends to Gallipoli, one of which, the 2nd First Londons, left from this very drill hall, which makes it extra special on their journey down there. You'll see straight away from those lovely divisional flashes that they serve piecemeal. They don't serve together. The Hackney Gurkhas and the Finsbury Rifles of 10th 11th Londons both serve in the 54th East Anglian Division. We have the 2nd 2nd and 2nd 4th Londons who serve with the Royal Naval Division, and then the 2nd 1st and 2nd 3rd Londons as part of the 29th Division. And in fact, it's only the Hackneys and the Finsburys that serve in the same brigade. So most of the presentations today are going to be talking about the 47th Division, a London Division, a London personality. These guys don't have that luxury as such. The second thing we should straight away look at is the dates they arrive, because for many people, Gallipoli conjures up stories of Anzacs wading ashore, sea running red with blood, that sort of thing, or Victoria Crosses being awarded before breakfast. Well, the earliest landing of the London battalions is on the 15th of August. And of course, the last offensive battle of the campaign is the 21st in and around Scimitar Hill. So what we also see is that only two battalions actually participate in an attack during the whole of the campaign. So it's a very different experience to what a lot of troops would have gone through if they'd served at Gallipoli. So the principal finding of the paper that I've been putting together is quite simply that, unlike the Western Front or Palestine, where the battalions fought as part of a cohesive London division with that culture and that identity, when it came to Gallipoli, this was at the time and remains a very individual battalion experience. And very few of the battalions cross-reference each other when it comes to how the campaign went forward. So we should start with those that took part in one of the attacks. And I stand here today with the sand of the Dardanelles still between my toes, because I landed last night at 10 o'clock. So I've been fresh off of the Gallipoli battlefields. And in fact, last week we were up at the Kerich Tepe Ridge. This was more of an enabling action on the 15th of August that was partly fought by the 10th Irish Division, or two brigades of, supported by the 54th East Anglian Division, to clear the Kerch Tepe ridge, which would then also enable the main force to break out across the Suvla Plain, which at this time it was already established. We'd not made the ground that we should have made in the first 48 hours of the campaign, and was now an area covered by snipers, and we either needed to command the high ground or a complete sniper drive to withdraw them. Now, bearing in mind that these battalions landed and within 3 days found themselves going straight into action, photograph you see there is taken on the Kerch Tepe Ridge. There are very limited sources other than the war diaries that we can quote from. In fact, the Bedfordshire Regiment probably has the best sort of quotes on the battle. We don't have time to go into them totally today. However, this is what the regimental history of the Bedford says. There was a brief pause for reorganisation before the battalion was launched against Kidney Hill, its second objective. Up to this time, the casualties had not been particularly heavy, but the next hill to be carried was far more formidable obstacle. London, Essex and Bedford territorials charged together, but the men of the 5th Bedfords outstripped the regiments on their right and their left, dashed into the lead, causing the line to form a crescent and sweeping everything before them. Now that sounds very glamorous, but of course that's written by the regimental historian for the regiment. And it wasn't quite as clear-cut that the 5th Bedfords are the only ones to advance that day. In the official history, it's merely a footnote that regards that in the 3 battalions of 162 Brigade that engaged, the total casualties in the attack amounted to 37 officers and 900 men, which is roughly one of those 3 battalions within the first hours of going into action, and a lot of that experience was lost. Now, where was the Kerch Tepe Ridge? I don't expect you all to have been to Gallipoli, but this is a map of the Suvla Plain here with the Salt Lake, which was crusted over at the time. Really, you needed to advance straight up the middle there and then kink off to the right to capture the positions of Scimitar Hill and W Hill to have any hope of success. Kerch Tepe Ridge was the high ground to the north that I've ringed there in the red ring. But maps are flat. And it's only when you look at the ground itself you get to understand the problems they had. And this 3D imagery shows you the actual battlefield that this brigade fought across. Having landed at Gallipoli 3 days earlier, that is almost a battlefield on an angle. So how you keep direction, how you keep order going forward on that would have been quite horrific. It really is the end of the offensive capability of that Hackney battalion at Gallipoli in particular. Their casualties are so high they're not able to be used again going forward as a single battalion in an attack. Meanwhile, down at Helles, it was completely different. And this save so far removed from the initial landings of the River Clyde that you can see on this contemporary sketch to the south at V Beach, or where the 2 blocks coming in, that represents the second and fourth Londons that arrive in the October of 1915. By the time they arrive, no more is this the horror that had been on the 20th of April. And in fact, one of the quotes we got here from Stephen Chambers' marvellous book on Gallipoli says, it was described by a battalion medical officer as a gigantic morgue and open latrine. Helles had been transformed into a fly-blown plague pit of typhoid, cholera and dysentery. Corpses in various stages of decomposition, buried beneath trench floors or revetted into sandbag walls, were regularly unearthed by working parties, whilst piles of dead mown down during previous assaults and out of reach to both sides for months on end, rotted between the opposing lines that were normally just 100 yards distance. In fact, the Director of Medical Services for 8 Corps says there is throughout the troops a general feeling of lassitude and depression which lowers the power of resistance to disease. However, I expect the measures intended to boost morale and the new Corps commander will introduce will make a positive difference. So the head of medicine is saying that this is no so bad here, this morale, that we're actually losing our combat efficiency. Now, to quote someone that's in the room, Professor Gary Sheffield wrote in a BCMH journal that when Joey Davis took over in August 1915, that Joey had a very practical approach to improving morale. He sought to improve leisure facilities, for instance, by providing refreshments, raising bands for the personnel of each division, and by staging sports matches. two snapshots of this effort were Hood and Anson teams playing football in the RND final of the Dardanelles Cup and the 52nd Division's band's rendition of the Mikado that was interrupted by shelling. They seem very whimsical, but what a difference this makes to the campaign. Now, we're quite fortunate in London annals in that at the Imperial War Museum there is a collection of letters by this chap, Sid Ablewhite, who served with the 2nd Londons. I felt when I opened them, no one had ever looked at them. They looked like they'd been still wrapped up from the day they'd first been given by the family. Now, that's part because Sid doesn't survive the war. But I'm just going to read briefly a couple of letters that he writes from the time. In November 1915, he says, "It's very cold at nights. We have no head cover, so we feel it. I don't suppose we should get a roof again for some time. Last night it rained and it was pleasant, but it takes a lot to dampen the spirits of some men. In a trench next to me during an extra downpour, one of the men said, 'Crikey, ain't it all right, oi? It reminds me of my old home on the embankment.' And then he started singing, 'It's a long, long way to Alibaba, and we ain't downhearted yet. Everyone is wonderfully cheerful, and in the morning, we play lots of football, and we dodge the shells in between.'" What's interesting about the second Londons, and it is relevant to a long debate that occurred in the Gallipoli Association journals throughout the 1980s, is who was the last off the peninsula. And actually, Sid is able to say, "Of course you would have heard," writing to his father from Alexandria this is, "you would have heard of the final evacuation of the peninsula. We have not seen any papers for weeks and know nothing about what's going on in the war, but I am anxious to see what it says about the final evacuation. One thing you must be proud to know is that I was the last but one man to leave the peninsula. The other one was the demobilisation officer who fired the fuses to blow up the mines. He left the shore with me. I took him the orders to fire it up. I felt it a distinction and proud of it myself, but will never forget the last week or the last few hours. Of course, nothing of the details will be in the papers. When I left the shore, there was not a single Britisher or Frenchman of any sort left at Gallipoli. It seemed so weird to be practically the last man to have the land that all the world had been watching for months and months. The reason I came to be the last man to leave was this. I was told to get 20 men from my company and take them to report to the principal landing officer on the River Clyde. I chose my football team. When I got there, I was told that my men were required to act as guides to lead the troops down to the beach, and as they left their position in the trenches, it was a night work only. Several thousands left each night, as well as thousands of Frenchmen, and it took us 8 nights to clear everyone off the peninsula. As I was in charge of the guides, I naturally had to see that every man, including the guides, left the shore. The demolition officer then fired all the fuses and left the beach with me. I called the roll of my men, and then I stepped on board." So they might have been not been the first in, but the second seconds were certainly the last out. Now, probably Sid's story has never come to light because there's no happy ending for these guys, and Sid was unfortunately killed in the lead to the Somme and is buried in Heberton Cemetery, by which time he was attached to the 16th Queen's Westminsters, of which a lot of men in that battalion were. Perhaps the most famous person that served in that battalion is that young chap there, that I'm sure some of you may recognise. That's him as a young drummer boy in Malta at the time. He went by the name of Billy Cotton, who was a very talented footballer, played football for the battalion football team, as well as a racing driver, and then erstwhile turned his attention to things like, "I've got a lovely bunch of coconuts" and what have you. Billy Cotton writes, "As part of the football team, I was detailed for an ammunition carrying party from W Beach. I was on that beach loading up one day when I saw Kitchener come ashore. He walked over W Beach and inland for half a mile. He was gesticulating, but I couldn't hear what he was saying. Shortly after, on the 15th of November, during a 52nd Lowland Division attack, we supported them on our right, and we attacked a Turkish trench by rifle and machine gun fire and bombing. Before the attack, 3 mines were exploded, and the lads rushed forward, took the trenches and barricaded themselves on the forward side. The Turks brought down fire and caused a number of casualties, including my company commander, Captain Duckfield. I did my best to restore morale, and I said to my company sergeant major, 'I'll bet you any money, like, we ain't here in a month's time.' And I told him about Kitchener. Well, it was actually 2 months before the two and tuppennies moved out because we were the last to go." Now, what they were actually talking about a lot of time was football, and I'll mention this very briefly, is that I was intrigued to find out where football was played on the peninsula, format and slightly different on this to how I wanted it, but not to worry. I got contacted by John Winterburn, who is the landscape archaeologist for the Jazz Railway. Obviously can't get out to Jordan at the moment. He's got software, and he said there is only one possible location where football could be played at Hellas, and that is using this software program. It's roughly to the south of where it says football in that little square there. And incredibly, when I looked through some of the maps I had, this is the 52nd Lowland Division map of evacuation. And if you look at that red ring, there's clearly a football pitch marked on that map. So we now know where the football was played. So when everyone else is going across the ground looking for bullets and shrapnel balls, I'm looking for studs. And on top of that, what were they playing for? Well, if you look on the right there, you can see that little trophy is not the Dardanelles Cup, but that was Brigadier General Stockwell's own competition, because the tournament, the Dardanelles Cup, was in divisional format. So you played as a division, then you played the winners of another division, and then you got to the final, of which Anson Battalion won the whole thing. So this was one of Stockdale's Cup. This is the trophy that Billy Cotton and Sid Appleton-White would have played for. I think they get to the quarter-final before they're beaten, but what I have brought with us today is one of those trophies for you to look at, because the morale was such an important part of keeping the Gallipoli campaign going. I've got 2 minutes left, don't I? Okay, so we will move on to the most horrific part of the Londoners' experience at Gallipoli. And for a battalion that doesn't indulge themselves in a single attack, the 2nd, 3rd Londons have the largest number of names of missing on the Hellas Memorial there. And this is from, when you look them up, they all die on the 28th of November 1915. So let's look what happens there. Well, it's the Great Storm. Private Underwood says, "Within a minute, I was slept off my ledge where I was sleeping and lay in a foot of water. I began to think that the Turks were letting a dam loose as the water was steadily rising. Captain Bateman, his commander, said, the men's joints were so stiff from the cold, they had to be lifted onto the fire step and lifted on again when their tour of duty was over." The 2nd, 3rd London's Regimental Magazine, looking back at this time, quotes, "The men were at first amused to see no man's land turned into a lake. The water, however, quickly rose and flooded the trenches. Standing in the fire step, the men were up to their waists in water. And 50 men drowned or died of exposure that night, with over 300 being evacuated with frostbite." So the storm in November 1915, more London Regiment soldiers were killed than in any action in the whole of the campaign. It just seems mind-numbing, that, doesn't it? One of the things that I will take time to read, it's not too long, but it's worth listening to, is the medical report by the Director of Medical Service of the 54th Division, which is where the Hackneys and Finsbury Rifles were serving, because he writes in November, "I made an inspection of as many troops of the 54th Division as possible yesterday, and I saw the conditions under which they were living in the trenches and dugouts. There are a very considerable number of immature lads in the ranks. Many of these are of poor physique and are not robust men, have been recruited from shoemakers or working in shops and storehouses. The conditions under which the troops of this division are living are the same as all those of other troops in the Corps. I found nothing wrong with the sanitary conditions. However, 36 out of the 87 recruits we just received were under the age of 19, and one by his own admission was under 16. The usual wish was for all sides was more variety in the rations. Flour was unattainable. This is a great pity as it prevents men from eating suet puddings and plum duff. Meat is issued 3 times a week and the allowance of water is small. Many of the young officers are reporting sick and it has been necessary to establish a kind of convalescent camp to which slighter cases of these can go so we can stop the evacuations. There have been 21 cases of self-inflicted injury in the 54th Division in the last 2 months, and there is only one battalion commander out of those that came out of the division who still remains. 54th Division evacuates twice the percent of cases than the whole of the ANZAC Corps does each month. There are two simple ways we can stop this. The first one is improvement of rations, which is already taken into account. The second one is steps might be taken to obtain footballs for the men. These could be kicked about in the gullies and off-duty times, and this would form an abstraction and a recreation. And that's from the Surgeon General of the Corps up in Suvla Bay. So these guys, by the time the drafts are coming in, are really reaching the end of their tether. And I'll conclude with something that we've probably got to do a bit more research on. Hold on. Because these are only approximate casualties. But if you look at that, you'll see the Turkish bullet was not the real attritional factor in the Gallipoli campaign. It was conditions and disease. 39 killed in the second Londons, 923 evacuated sick. That wipes out the battalion. And it goes down, unfortunately, that the way it's formatted, the picture has gone over the top. But the only real battle casualties are in those Hackney battalion on that 15th of August. So a lot still to research, but this is going to be quite a sorry tale for the London Regiment they're experiencing in Gallipoli, and it's one of coping not only with the Turks, but also with the conditions and also with disease. Okay.
Thank you, Clive.
You have been listening to the Mentioned in Dispatches podcast from the Western Front Association with me, Tom Thorpe. Thank you for all my guests for appearing on this edition. The theme music for this podcast was George Butterworth's The Banks of Green Willow. It was performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Krish Rusman, and produced by Biz Records. This recording is part of a collection of orchestral works by Butterworth performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales and supported by the Western Front Association. This is available from all good record stores under the record code BIS 2195. Until next time.